Well, that certainly makes me want to read the book, Lloyd, and thank you very much. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Martha Bayless. Many of you probably had the same experience that I had I guess it's a 7-year period, it seems like even longer, when she was the television and arts critic for the Wall Street Journal, of always looking forward to her pieces, always finding an interesting, provocative, and really entertaining point of view in commentary, and often things that I found surprising to be in the staid, business-like pages of the Wall Street Journal. Martha has a long career in writing. She's the author of 2 books, Ain't That a Shame, Censorship and Culture, and the Culture of Transgression, and Hole in Our Soul, The Loss of Beauty and Meaning in American Popular Music. She's also contributed to more books than I could possibly recite in the few minutes that I have here, and she's had essays and articles in just about every important journal of ideas and opinion in the country, including our own Reason magazine. She had got her BA from Harvard in art history, and it's a master's in education, Graduate School of Education, University of Pennsylvania. And she is currently a visiting instructor in civilization and literature at Claremont McKenna College, and we're delighted to have her at least temporarily as a Californian. Martha?
Thank you very much. And I'll stomp around up here a lot. It makes the surface here shake, but if any of you feel any shaking out there, just raise your hands and we'll all get under the table. We did last night. The title of my talk is Immunity, Not Surgery. The metaphor takes a while to surface, but I'll plant the seed now, to use another metaphor. Some of us here have been watching the culture war merry-go-round for several years now. Like most merry-go-rounds, it's mostly horses. Same old debating points, scored in the same old way, going up and down and round and round. Every now and then, something more interesting comes by, like a camel or a llama, or maybe a little cart pulled by a pair of swans. One such exotic beast is the violence in media beast. We saw that one go by last spring, when after the shootings in Littleton, Colorado, Congress began huffing and puffing at Hollywood to be more responsible. And President Clinton ordered the Federal Trade Commission to conduct an exhaustive study of whether the entertainment industry markets violent products to children. Just what we need, another study. More recently, we saw another fabulous creature go by, the publicly funded art scandal. We haven't seen that one for a while, but there it was in the form of the now famous Sensation exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum. 10th-rate art jacked up by a first-class media blitz. In events like this, you can forget the dismal objects inside the building. The outraged response of public officials and the subsequent media blitz are the real work of art. Now, these culture scandals are all very exciting while they're going on. And as several commentators have noted, each of the main players benefits. Politicians get to posture on C-SPAN. Hollywood titans get to wrap themselves in the ACLU edition of the First Amendment. Fat cat collectors and auction houses get even fatter. Obscure video companies, outer borough museums, and Johnny-come-lately avant-garde artists get firestorms of publicity. And lawyers get to sling the kind of dung that doesn't come from elephants. Really, the only ones who get hurt in all this fracas are the genuine artists, the people who are trying to do good things in popular culture, and, of course, the public. Meanwhile, the intellectuals soldier on with the classic debate over censorship in a liberal democracy. In the Weekly Standard, in the journal Society, and elsewhere lately, the pro-censorship case has recently been set forth again by some of its eminent proponents, Irving Kristol, Walter Burns, Robert Bork, David Lowenthal, and others. This case is familiar and compelling. Liberal democracy cannot survive unless its citizens have good moral character. If we cannot govern ourselves individually, the argument goes, we will not be able to govern ourselves collectively. Therefore, liberal government has an overriding interest in curbing negative moral influences, even if it means greater imposition of curbs on free speech and expression than we now have. and the standard reply is equally familiar and equally compelling. Libertarians and free speech absolutists warn that all governments, even liberal ones, tend to trespass on the liberty of their citizens. Therefore, it's better to tolerate negative moral influences, even flagrant abuses, than to give government the dangerous power to censor. Now, much as I respect both of these arguments, I feel that they, too, have begun to go up and down and around and around. This is because they fail to address the two most salient features of our current cultural predicament. Or at least I'll say they fail to address these features adequately. The first of these features is the growing inability of government to regulate or control the electronic media. And the second is what I call the culture of transgression. And I'll discuss each of these in turn. First, the media. When I teach a course in censorship at Claremont McKenna College, my students are always amazed to learn that our famous regime of free speech is actually two regimes, one for the print media and the fine arts, and another for the electronic media and popular culture. For the better part of this century, each has granted a different degree of liberty. With regard to print and the fine arts, our liberties are now unprecedented. This is the result of 100 years' war over the depiction of sex in literature that began in 1857 when British Parliament passed the Obscene Publications Act, otherwise known as Lord Campbell's Act, which empowered any local magistrate to confiscate any publication that was, in his opinion, obscene. Lord Campbell's Act became the model for American law, only to be challenged in both countries by a long series of court cases culminating in the British Obscene Publications Act of 59 and 64, and of course in the United States in the 1973 Supreme Court case Miller versus California, which narrowed the legal definition of obscenity to the so-called slaps test. That's not what you think. A work is obscene only if taken as a whole it lacks, quote, serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Slaps. You skip the V. And we all know what happened next. In the realm of culture, there is now a legal loophole big enough to accommodate a customized sport utility vehicle. To escape prosecution, all a writer or artist needs to do is claim serious artistic value. The satirical songwriter Tom Lehrer captured this some years ago in his immortal lyric, "As the judge said on the day that he acquitted my Aunt Hortense, to be smut, it must be utterly without redeeming social importance." Just thank your stars I didn't sing it. With hindsight, we can see that this art loophole, as I call it, has been both blessing and curse. Blessing because the law now distinguishes between serious art that deals with the erotic side of life and mindless trash that pursues prurience for its own sake. But here's the curse. In the post-war period, a certain kind of writer began deliberately to blur this distinction. If Lehrer had looked at literature, his lyric might have gone this way. As the judge said on the day that he acquitted Henry Miller, the whole point here is high-class smut. The rest is merely filler. Miller's Tropic of Cancer, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, and a host of other literary works, including the works of that classic comeback kid, the Marquis de Sade, passed through the art loophole bearing increasingly generous dollops of obscenity, followed quickly by pornography itself, piggybacking on the visual and performing arts. To quote Robert Mapplethorpe, quote, "There was a feeling I could get looking at pornographic imagery that had never been apparent in art. And I thought if I could somehow retain that feeling, then I would be doing something that is uniquely my own," unquote. What about the electronic media? I did start off talking about that. Does the art loophole exist there too? And if so, how does it work? Well, it exists sometimes in the way I've been discussing. In October 1990, a Cincinnati jury ruled the Mapplethorpe exhibit not obscene by virtue of being art. 2 weeks later, another jury in Florida came to the same verdict about the rap group Two Live Crew. You remember them, don't you? In the Two Live Crew case, there were plenty of experts on hand to inform the local Florida rustics that the group's foul and violent spew was a fine expression of Afro-American sensibility. Just as an aside, I quote a fellow named Steve Gallon, who was a black comedian in the 70s, who was often mentioned as a source for Two Live Crew. He was interviewed on the Washington Post, and he gave this comment, which shows that he at least understands the legal definition of obscenity. He said, "I wouldn't take my mother near Two Live Crew. That's not entertainment to me. That's porno. We have a gentleman's approach to our comedy, and we're basically up there to make you laugh, not to insult you or insult your integrity." Now, we may differ about Steve Gallon's records, but there's a distinction even there to be made. Yet apart from the Two Live Crew case, the artifacts of popular culture rarely end up in court in this way. And that's because, partly because, these media are governed by a different regime, one of indirect, but until recently, fairly stringent government control. Now, I say indirect, which I will emphasize in a moment, but just to illustrate the difference between the two regimes, if you don't believe me, let me compare James Joyce's Ulysses. The ban on publication of Ulysses was lifted in the United States in 1933. 50 years later, in New York, a Pacifica radio station had to battle with the FCC to read the novel on the air. Now, this is how the second regime of regulation works. This will be tiresome to some of you, but it's an important part of the argument. The U.S. government does not own the electronic media, but it does structure the marketplace. The goal repeatedly stated by the government is to foster competition by creating a level playing field. Of course, it's a playing field for giants. The giants go out in the field, the government sits on the sidelines, making sure they play nicely. If they don't, the government starts huffing and puffing. And until recently, this huffing and puffing from the sidelines has worked. It has intimidated the giants to take self-policing steps. Hence the Hays Office, which monitored feature films between the 30s and the 60s, the Departments of Standards and Practices, which until recently kept fair tabs on network television, and of course the rating systems of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. It is this self-policing regime which has given us the V-chip and is now mucking around trying to develop an effective filtering technology for the internet. But the point I wish to make is this second regime, the one that depends on industry self-policing, is losing its grip. Consider the V-chip, inserted into every TV set manufactured after the turn of the millennium. Like all rating systems, the V-chip depends on having the power somewhere along the line to segregate viewers by age. After some haggling, the networks and cable companies have adopted the MPAA rating systems, which classifies material according to how old a person must be in order to see it. That's why the ratings have names like PG-13 and NC-17. But where exactly will this age segregation be enforced? The MPAA rating system makes sense 25 years ago, when every movie theater had a more or less responsible gatekeeper at the front door checking ages and IDs. But with the advent of cable movie channels and VCRs, it became virtually obsolete. By the same token, ratings have never been used in broadcasting because of the inconvenient fact that families tend to have children of different ages living under the same roof. The V-chip would work like a charm if every household consisted of technologically mature and responsible adults and tiny, obedient, helpless offspring. But regrettably, many households also contain those frightening and meddlesome and computer-adept creatures known as adolescents. Because it is impractical to age segregate in the home, the original standard of acceptability in broadcast media was modeled, I'd say more or less, on the old Hicklin rule, the British test for obscenity that was set down in 1868. Under Hicklin, nothing could be published that proved harmful to the most vulnerable reader. As Judge Learned Hand later remarked, the problem with the Hicklin rule was that it imposed on all published material the, quote, standard of a child's library. Now, it would be naive, would it not, to try to impose the Hicklin rule in today's media environment. Yet that's pretty much what Senator Henry Hyde did last June when he proposed a measure making it a crime to sell, distribute, or lend violent movies, TV programs, videos, books, and internet material to children. The measure was defeated, no doubt because many senators understood that it would probably meet the same fate as the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which tried to outlaw not just obscenity on the internet, but indecency on the internet. and it has been a long time since indecency was considered unprotected speech in this country. Like it or not, that's how it is, at least in the print realm. As I've been suggesting, the debate over censorship varies according to which of our two regimes you're talking about. When the Communications Decency Act was argued before the Supreme Court, therefore, the legal problem, and it was a very thorny one, was not the message, it was the medium, defining the medium. As one reporter noticed at the time, the real question wasn't what's on the net, it was what is the net. Now, how exactly do we define a smut peddler in cyberspace? As a creep threatening children in a city playground to be publicly shamed if not locked up? As a proprietor of a pornographic movie theater to be zoned into a red light district and required to exclude minors? As a broadcaster to be placed under the watchful eye and raised eyebrow of the FCC? As a video store to be subject to local ordinance and or company policy when it comes to requiring proof of age before renting certain material? As an artist exempt from prosecution under existing obscenity law? Or as a citizen exercising his right to political speech in a public forum? Well, I'm not going to try to resolve that question. If you want my opinion, it's not going to be resolved anytime soon. But let me ask you a different question now. What if it were resolved? What if all of a sudden our lawmakers and our courts summoned the political will to impose strict controls on the electronic media, including the internet? Would they be enforceable? I think not. Let me quote an experienced censor, James Furman, who was for many years the director of the British Board of Film Classification, formerly the British Board of Film Censorship. He wonders if the board can continue to function in the age of the internet. Here's what he said. What's the point of cutting a gang rape scene in a British version of a film if the same film is accessible down a telephone line from outside British territorial waters? Now, some governments are not deterred by this problem. We've all heard of the great Chinese firewall that is supposed to emit only harmful and toxic, supposed to emit only useful information into the People's Republic, keeping out toxins such as rock music and political dissent. Yet to judge by similar efforts elsewhere, today's Big Brothers can't even control CNN, much less the internet. The cyberpunks have a point when they say, this is how they put it, quote, the internet interprets censorship as damage and roots around it. Well, this is very good news for the free flow of information. But it's bad news when we consider that part of that flow is polluted. And part of the pollution is the culture of transgression. The culture of transgression is not easy to define, but like Justice Potter Stewart on obscenity, we do tend to know it when we see it. On both the elite and the popular levels of our culture, it is marked by depictions of sex and violence that are unfeeling, indifferent, detached from the consequences of action, and conspicuously contemptuous of any moral concern. Extreme fighting, lap dancing, that sort of thing. The culture of transgression, by contrast, bears the mark of the intellectual. Its elite avatars read Foucault. Its popular aesthetic is derived from the Oliver Stone and Quentin Tarantino school of guts and yucks filmmaking. As an elite phenomenon, the culture of transgression isn't new as an elite phenomenon. It derives from a perverse strain within modernist art that for the last 100 years has rejected tradition instead of mastering it, has mocked artistic standards instead of updating them, and has chosen to shock and offend instead of making people think or feel. Mind you, I'm not speaking of all modernist art, only of a perverse strain within it. A good way to identify this strain, past and present, is to ask when you're told for the umpteenth time that some particular work of art is making you think, is to ask, well, what is it making me think? And then see what the answer is. What's new and troubling is that in the last few decades, Since the 60s, the culture of transgression has become a mass phenomenon. Now, this is new. A bag of tricks that was once the property of a tiny avant-garde is now universally available through media that are, as I've been arguing, harder than ever to control. Now, how this is all going to turn out, I have no idea. On a good day, the kind when popular culture seems capable of self-correction, I'm optimistic. Indeed, I've been known to argue, better a plebiscite on this garbage than the verdict of the so-called arts community. But on a bad day, the kind when I share the social conservative vision of public morality eroded by pornography, I see a juggernaut at work. One that has already made a joke out of promiscuity and is doing the same with cruelty and abuse. I fear the triumph of this juggernaut, and I fear the backlash that will inevitably follow. Well, I will try to be brief in my ending. My solution is the best I can talk about is a metaphor from the realm of cybersecurity, which has been studying RAND Corporation and the military and studying ways to control information warfare, logic bombs, and other forms of terrorism that might travel into our information space by terrorists. And their conclusion, they came to not too long ago, was that erecting perfect barriers around public networks is not only impractical, but probably desirable. The Chinese government can try surgery, but the RAND Corporation and the US military would prefer immunity. They would like to find a system that would mimic a biological immune system. And they're intrigued by the possibility of developing software agents that act like antibodies. Well, I like that idea, because it suggests to me how cultural authority should be wielded along the antibody model. And I'll say just a couple of things about that. First of all, antibodies are active. They don't just assume that because something's circulating in the bloodstream, it's okay. Here I draw a parallel with a kind of blind faith in the free market that whatever's popular is a good thing. Second, antibodies are precise. They size up the toxin before they attack it. Here, my point is, be knowledgeable of what you're criticizing. Politicians, and especially intellectuals, often pride themselves on being ignorant of offensive material. Ignorance, however, is ignorance in every field. It doesn't impress, and it doesn't persuade. Third, antibodies work not for their own good, but for the whole. When they batten on a toxin, it's not just to fatten themselves. Public officials who neglect to weigh in at the appropriate stage in cultural decision-making lose credibility when they do so later. For example, if Mayor Giuliani of New York, in my opinion, was really concerned about the religious sensibilities of New York's Catholics, then perhaps his office should have said so 10 months before, when his commissioner for cultural affairs and two other representatives of his office met with Arnold Lehman of the Brooklyn Museum, heard a complete description of the Sensation exhibition, and signed off on it. Fourth, antibodies are small and local. Here my point is simply that the higher status the person, especially if it's a public official, the less effective the attack in some ways, because this is like putting gasoline on the flames. The culture of transgression, this is how it works. There's nothing more welcome to someone who says that they're a victim of the system than being attacked by the system. You know, during the last presidential election, when Bill Bennett and Bob Dole were attacking gangster rappers and industrial rockers, was Madonna relieved that her name wasn't on their list? I think not. I think she was disappointed that her name was not on their list, because she understands, as do so many others, that being on the hit list of a politician is a shortcut to the chart. Okay, I'll skip my discussion of the old left and the popular front.
Sorry.
Okay, finally, antibodies know what they're protecting. And here I would argue the importance of affirmative cultural authority. It's fine to criticize. It's also important to point out what's good and to say why it's good and to do it in as prominent and conspicuous way as you can. Unfortunately, I don't think conservative critics are especially good at this. course, I have not yet read the latest Reason magazine. Now, this is not a form of cultural relativism that I'm arguing. It's a form of trying to appreciate the connections between what's going on in popular culture and what used to be called high culture. I think the connections are very real and they're very strong. The problems with popular culture are not simply a product of the marketplace or of popular taste. They have intellectual and high cultural roots. I think the more we understand that, the more we talk about it and teach it to our children, the better off we will be. And in the end, it is this patient work of criticism, of self-correction, and teaching that is most imperiled by censorship. The clumsy would-be censor and the would-be transgressor are made for each other. The transgressor strikes his pose of the avant-garde artiste who is persecuted, and the censor is usually left rather in a futile position. To the active, precise, and intimate use of cultural authority, however, the transgressor has no defense, really, especially if the criticism is accurate and to the point. All he can do is cry censorship and hope that the cameras are running.